This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk. Over the Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hi, I'm Davina from Devon. I've been super curious for quite a few years. Never really made it stick because, well, everybody drinks alcohol, right? Anyway, I decided to join OTI after listening to the pod and just the enthusiasm from Ben and Shaz shouting about AF life. I'm so glad I joined the community because I'm now nearly 200 days alcohol free. It's an absolute game changer for me. Everybody on the Zooms are lovely. It's just like one great big extended family and we're all just cheering everybody on. I would recommend without hesitation that you join because it's just the best thing I've ever done.
You've heard the podcast, now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to Over the Influence. We have got a superb guest lined up for you today. We just knew that when we reached out to this world-famous author, no less, and she said yes. She said yes. We all got a bit giddy. We all got a bit excited. We are a bit giddy. We are a bit excited. So just bear with. We will be introducing our guest very, very shortly. For your benefit, if you are just tuning in for the very first time, and also for the benefit of today's guest, who probably hasn't got a clue who we are, let me explain. We started this alcohol-free podcast around a dining room table in Liverpool at the start of the pandemic, approaching 2 years ago, the three of us. My name is Sharon Hartley, 48 years old, used to be a daily drinker, ramped it up at weekends, three kids, one husband and a beagle, live in lovely Lancashire in the northwest of England. Decided to take a break from booze September 2018 and now approaching 3.5 years alcohol free. Today's guest, actually, her book was on my bedside table. It was part of my toolkit, my AF quit lit toolkit, but we'll get into all that very, very shortly. I don't do this on my own. Allow me to introduce my very tanned, he gets bronzer and more blonde by the week. He's on the other side of the world. He's called Freddie, he's in New Zealand, and his trotters are throbbing. Hello, Freddie.
I do have throbbing trotters because I did run a marathon yesterday, and that is the joy of the alcohol-free lifestyle. But yes, I am now less than a month away from being 3 years alcohol-free. Not so long ago, I used to live a very corporate, very jet set, very heavy drinking lifestyle. I would fly around the world and frequent hotel bars and suffer a couple of blackouts on my way. But then I changed my drinking habits, I changed my life, and I never looked back. I'm so excited to be here on the world's favourite alcohol-free podcast, and I am super, super excited about our guest today.
But not as excited as background, Ben. So very briefly, background Ben, it used to be in the background when we first started this podcast. Ben enjoyed a beer or three. He spent a lot of time editing myself and Freddie wanging on about sobriety. And then Ben made the decision to go alcohol free. Hello, Ben. Just introduce yourself, please.
Hello, I'm Ben, and I'm really excited because Sarah Heppel is our guest today. I'm sorry, I let the cat out of the bag. I can't help it.
Useless.
The world famous Sarah Heppel. It's amazing because I went alcohol-free 18 months ago now, and this was one of the first books that I read. Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget, was on, Chaz, it was on my bedside table too. And I remember reading this book and first of all just thinking how cool this woman was. Like, just, she oozes cool. But then it was just such an honest account. And I think I was quite shocked and taken aback when I read this book for the very first time, because it is the opening chapter. We'll talk about it shortly, but it just throws you in to this completely honest and open account. And yeah, 18 months for me. I never going to drink again. You know, I feel quite confident in saying that now. For the first few months, I wasn't, you know, I did a 3 month break, then extended it to six and then went, oh, I'm going to go for 12. It was on day 366 for me that I thought, I'm not going to do this anymore. My life is so much better without alcohol in it. I'm clearer headed. I've got more clarity than I ever have done before. I'm motivated. And I just want to live every single day. I'm sorry that I blew the intro, Shaz, but over to you because Sarah's here. And it's great.
Sarah, he's so giddy. I have never seen Ben as excited. Ben, just hold up, please. Just for the purposes of the Zoom, what have you got there on your desk?
I've got my copy of Blackout. Of course I have, because, you know, I've been rereading it, Sarah, knowing that you were coming on today.
It's great to see you so excited. Ben, Freddie, thank you so much. Sarah Heppeler, welcome to the podcast. Author of Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. It's an absolute joy to have you here. Sarah, before we get into talking about all things about the book, about you, about where you are now, about inspiring people, when I sent you an email a few weeks ago inviting you on the podcast, really, really excited, I said, yeah, we chat about sobriety, we wang on about sobriety, and you're like, what the hell is wanging on? Are you any clearer? Yeah.
No, because I've been letting that mystery dangle. It's too delicious. But I know whinging. That's a British term that I know. But I had never heard anybody say wanging on.
The G is really important.
Is it true in Britain that wang is slang for schlong?
Yes.
Right. Okay, yeah. Ben, do you want to jump in?
Not in this context. to be perfectly honest, Sarah, I'd never heard the phrase wanging on until I met Sharon, and it's a Lancashire thing. And if you're wanging on about something, it means you won't stop bloody talking about it. Like, oh, God, this Shaz wanging on about how the fact she's giving up booze again.
I'm excited to have this new vocabulary word and to use it in inappropriate times where my American friends will be like, what? And I'll be like, yeah, sure, it's a Lancashire thing.
Perfect.
Is it Lancashire? I don't even know the name.
There you go. Lancashire. No, I'll take Lancashire is the county. That's perfect, Sarah. I love it. So I just want to start by referring back to our intro. I mentioned your book. Ben mentioned your book. We've had it on the bedside tables when we started our alcohol-free journey, Sarah. How does that make you feel, knowing that what you did is been so instrumental in... Well, it's helped change my life, I know that, and countless others as well.
Very honored, and like I will inevitably disappoint you. No, you know what's interesting? I have two thoughts. One of them is that I wrote this book at a very lonely time in my own story. I was about 6 months sober, and I had completely gone into that hibernation mode. Like, I didn't know how to talk to people. I didn't know how to interact. Sure as hell didn't know how to date. I was just basically staying home and watching television and eating too much. And I was reading a bunch of books. And I remember thinking that I had an opportunity to write a book that I didn't see out there that was about women who drank like me. I mean, the book that I knew that I thought was really tremendous was Carolyn Knapp's Drinking a Love Story, but it's from 1997. And so it's very much about like the hidden drinking, which is still a story. It's still a part of many of our stories, but mine was so different. I was so proud of the way that I drank. I was really had come of age in this girl power era that was like, I was thrusting my cocktail glass in the face of the camera anytime the picture came my way. So that was a very different story. And, you know, and I was hoping that other people would find it. That was always probably my greatest hope, in addition to all the sort of ego stuff that you want. Like, I want to write a book. I want to make money, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I felt so useless and scared in those first months of sobriety. I didn't know how to find my way back to being in the world. And so I wanted to do that. And then the other thing it makes me think about is that we had sold this for a nice chunk of change in American markets. And we wanted to take it to England. And so this happens like after you finish the book, but before it comes out in America, you send it to the foreign markets. And we kept all these British public imprints looked at it, and we would get the funniest like feedback from them. They'd be like, we love this book. Does she have to get sober?
Really?
Yeah, they didn't like the part where I got sober. They wanted it to just be a funny Bridget Jonesy thing where I stay drunk. And then, like, they didn't like the AA, they didn't like the recovery. And this is, you got to remember, this is 2014. So a lot happened in society, and particularly British society, since then. It was very, very deeply, they did not like the God stuff. They did not like the recovery stuff. We were finally picked up by a wonderful publishing company called Two Roads that I'd like to give a shout out to, because they believed in this book. And they were absolutely right to do so. I get so many messages from my British, Australian, Irish, like, you know, people, India. They have distribution all around the world. And I'm so grateful for them believing in this book so that you guys could find it.
Sarah, so I shouldn't be going first because I'm the producer and these guys are the co-hosts, but I'm just so blooming excited to have you here that I'm just going to jump in. Talking about the kind of style of the book, it is very funny in lots of places. Can I just read a very quick bit from the very first chapter? And this is what I mean about kind of throwing you into it. And what you did, I suppose, with this book is completely change my perception on kind of how I felt about blackouts. Just long story short, I joke about them when I was growing up. You know, oh God, I had a great night last night. I can't remember any of it. And we were saying not long ago, I had someone say to me before Christmas, how was your Christmas party, mate? He said, oh yeah, I can't remember it. And I laughed along with him and I actually felt terrible afterwards because blackouts really are a serious thing. And the way that you phrase it here, you describe it as blackouts as my evenings come with trap doors. I don't know how much time I lose in this darkness or what takes place. When the curtain lifts again, this is what I see. There is a bed and I'm on it. The lights are low. Sheets are wrapped around my ankles, soft and cool against my skin. I'm on top of a guy I've never seen before and we're having sex. Hold on, can this be right? I'm having sex with a man and I've never seen him before. It's like the universe dropped me into somebody else's body, into someone else's life, but I seem to be enjoying it. I'm making all the right sounds. You know, that is, it's, I don't know, Shaz and Freddie, we've spoken about blackouts, but my God, like what a scary thing to happen. This isn't something that we should be joking and laughing off, is it? Blackouts.
I mean, it's such a deep question. It's like, I used to laugh at them too. I used to say it was God's little way of telling me I don't need to know what I did last night. And the thing is that there's a lot of us to do that. I have a friend that called it time travel. It is really, really weird that culturally we got to a place where we were drinking so much that parts of our brain started to shut down even as our bodies continued to function. It's a drinking induced amnesia, and we're treating that like it's a joke. It's actually like should be a Black Mirror episode.
Yeah.
Except that it's not a Black Mirror episode because you can go get booze at the corner store. So it's not some weird dystopia. It's what happens all the time, particularly on universities, but all across bars. And yeah, you know, like it's everywhere. The blackout that I describe in the opening was a doozy. I mean, when I was reading literature about blackouts, I would read these stories about guys, there's a couple of scary ones about guys coming to in a dark alleyway holding a knife, or somebody coming out of a blackout and seeing that their car had blood on it, but they didn't know where it was from. Those are really ghastly stories. But for a lot of women in particular, the ghastly blackout story that they have doesn't have to do with violence. It has to do with sex, and it has to do with random people that they ended up with, maybe not even remembering whether they instigated it, the other person instigated it, what was going on. It's a very disorienting experience. And when I had that experience, I mean, I remember it well. I was 30 years old. I had just moved to New York and I was in Paris on a magazine assignment. So I thought I was like on top of the world, and I'd had this crazy night drinking cognac all night, and it just, I mean, it completely brought the hammer down on me. And then there I was in this room on top of this guy, and I'm like, I was so confused too, because you have that fog. I was like, is this the person I'm supposed to be interviewing? Do I know him? Is this my boyfriend? Like, I couldn't get out of the fog. I really thought like, boy, like that particular thing had never happened to me, which was one of the reasons it became the beginning of the book, because it was so singular. But now that that book is out there, I hear from people all the time. Over the last 6 years, I've heard the most ghastly stories of people, especially young women, and especially on foreign vacations, for whatever reason, beaches, hotels, closets, alleyways that have had this experience. They're far from home. They don't know anybody. They might not even speak the language, and they don't know how to get out of it. And they never thought it happened to anybody else. And then here it is in the opening of a book. So yeah, should we be joking and laughing about blackouts? I don't get into shoulds because I don't, like, I don't. But I will say, I try to be gentle with my friends who are still in that world. And if they need to laugh off something that's scary and spooky, I'm not going to interrupt them with a, like, after school special moment, you know?
Yeah, my question for you, I think we've all had these moments, and yeah, thank goodness for pot plants is all I can say. We all have these moments and these blackouts, or at least many of us, I think, on this show do. And then it's what happens afterwards, because we've all been there in those quiet moments when we have the regret and we look in the mirror and we say to ourselves, I can't believe you did that. This is it. I have to change my habits. I have to change my ways and stop drinking or change my drinking habits. But we don't. And I think, am I right in saying after that incident that Ben mentioned, that you carried on the next day, you had a drink, and then we carry on. And it was the same for me and same for many of us. We say, I can never do that again. But then we don't change our behaviours immediately. And how did you find that shift in terms of saying, I know I need to change, but then actually starting to make those changes in your life?
Yeah, I mean, your story reminds me that, like, one of the reasons I think the human feels the need to laugh so much about the blackout is because the private experience of it is so terrible and scary, and you don't know what you did. And to not know what you did is really not a normal human experience. It's really, really bad. And it is fathomless because you could have done anything. So the night of that experience, I remember very clearly saying, I'm done. I had always waited for the moment when I was done. I'm done. I'm done. I'm 30 years old and I'm done. And then the next day on the plane, I don't like flying. And I drank on the plane because I was nervous. And I drank for another 5 years. Because drinking was a part of my life. And I just did the bargaining and the gerrymandering and the negotiation that everyone does when they're trying to hold on to something that's not really theirs to hold on to. You do this in relationships. You do this with jobs. You do this with all sorts of things. I did it with all those things too, but alcohol. And to answer your question of when does it go from I'm going to quit, and then I wake up the next morning and drink, because it was there for many years. It was there for so long, I didn't believe myself and I didn't actually think I could quit, which I always like to mention because I know there's people out there that are in that place. And so I was in that for 2 to 3 years of like, I think I can't actually stop. I mean, I didn't want to, but like, I didn't think I could. I didn't believe myself and I didn't hold myself to any promise. The only thing I can say is that it's almost like the air went out of my tires. I always thought that my drinking would end in a big bang, but it didn't at all. It was a total whimper. I had gone to a wedding. It was a friend's wedding. I couldn't remember how I got home. I woke up in bed with the cat, like, lying next to me. Everything seemed normal, but I had no idea. Like, had I taken my clothes off at the wedding? Had I embarrassed myself? Was I going to have to send apologies to all the people that I met? How did I get home? Did I sleep with somebody? There was nobody in the bed, but I didn't know. And I remember thinking like, well, I guess this is just my life, which is a very sad statement. When you're like, not even like upset about it, you're like, well, I guess this is it. And I don't know, something happened for me that night. I called my mom, who I'm very close to my mom, and she didn't really know how bad things were. And I just told her everything that I could at the time. And I knew that when I did that, I couldn't take it back. She would never forget. There was no amnesia, you know? Because you could trade friends, you could trade locations, you could trade bars, you could do all sorts of things, but you couldn't trade moms. I couldn't. And so I quit that day, and that was 11 years ago. And it will always be a mystery to me why that stuck and the other ones didn't, but it did.
you did that 11 years ago, which is it's just incredible. Fantastic. And I want to ask you about those 11 years and sobriety and looking forward away from the book. But when you wrote the book, you were 6 months sober. Is that right? 6 months?
Well, I told you that I was 6 months when I started thinking about a book. That book took me 3 years to write.
Okay, but the seed was planted at 6 months. That's a really big deal to be considering that sort of quite early on in your sobriety. Because thinking about when I got sober, I spent freaking 18 months just, and I still am a bit, obsessed about not drinking. And then what made you want to share so honestly and so openly? And it's so raw what you share. It's incredible. What prompted that?
Well, I have been something of a relapse queen for those years preceding. I would get a month and I would fall back, and I would get 3 months and fall back. And I was coming up on 6 months, and it was the most I'd ever had. And it was like there was this little devil in me that was like, well, 6 months is good. Why don't you go back and see if you can... You know, I needed to do something. I needed to stake my flag, like plant my flag in the ground of this side so that I wouldn't slide back. Because I was sadly realizing, I had a lot of grief over losing alcohol, and I would for a long time. And I thought, well, I wrote a story for Salon, which was an online magazine where I worked, and it was about quitting drinking, and it got a lot of attention. And I'm just like an attention whore. And I was like, oh, wow, everybody liked this. I should do more of it. And then I'd always wanted to write a book. I was always your friend sitting at the bar telling you about the book she was going to write one day. I never even really started a book. I had agents asking me for one. I mean, I had a great career. You know, I thought, oh, wow, there's this opportunity to do this thing that I had never done in my drinking life. I think I desperately needed to make sobriety matter and better, you know, because it didn't feel good. The first year didn't feel good. And I'm a very ambitious person. I'm hugely motivated by literary accomplishment, particularly at that time, because I didn't really have any. And so I knew that would maybe keep me strapped in, and so that I wasn't backsliding. And friends of mine told me, like, you should wait. I think my sponsor was like, you should wait a year. I was like, yeah. I mean, of course, I moved out of New York where I was living at the time, and I moved back to Dallas where my family lived. And I thought I was going to write that book in 4 months, and it took me 3 years. So it didn't work out at all the way that I wanted it to. But what happened in those years was that I actually started to like my sobriety. See, when I started it, I hated my sobriety. So I was going to end the story the same way all the other stories end, which is like, ta-da, I got sober, bye now. And because you don't want to go into the sober years, because they can be very painful, very difficult, very awkward, slow, uncomfortable, and they can be the same way for the reader. So that's a real challenge, but I'm very proud that I have 5 years of my sobriety in there so that people can walk alongside me and see how all the things that you were drinking for, you can start to find in other ways. And they might not be the same, but they can often be much deeper and more profound because they're earned. They're not delivered through, you know, a bottle of Jack.
What did your mom think of the book?
Well, my mom is, I think, deeply proud of it. But, you know, it's a tough day in a family when one of the kids announces she's writing a memoir, especially when the memoir is about her troubled drinking. And that story includes stealing her mom's beer from the age of 7 or 8. And my mother is haunted by the mother she felt that she couldn't be. She, like all mothers, had her own life and her own challenges. She became a therapist, and she's one of my favorite people in the world. But, you know, she was growing up while I was growing up, because parents do that. And she missed some things that she wishes she hadn't. And she was, I hope it's okay for me to say this, but like she was racked with anxiety and guilt for a long time leading up to this book, because she was afraid of what people were going to think of her. And she didn't let me see that much. And that's pretty heroic of her because she didn't want me to slow down or stop. But after it was out, she was like, you know, whew, wow, thank God. Because, you know, she says now that it's a real gift, that it's a gift that I gave to our family because I told the truth about a story that exists in both lines of our family tree, which is that my parents are not alcoholics, but they are related to many. let me say it a gentler way. We have a lot of empty bottles around our family tree. I don't really know who was an alcoholic. What I know is there was a ton of drinking. I'm Irish and Finnish, and it's a S show. So, and I think that what she found, in the same way what I found, was that people were like, wow, your mom's amazing. Like, your mom was totally there for you. Because they really saw, like, the part where she was there in my sobriety and my adulthood. And they didn't really focus on, like, how she didn't catch me when I was 11 or 12, you know? So, I mean, I have no, neither of us knows what people say behind our back, but, you know, my mother is an exceptional mother and she made mistakes like all mothers do. So, yeah.
She was growing up while you were growing up. That's blown my mind to think that. As a kid, you don't think that, do you? As a kid, they're like, the grown-ups are adults.
I'm still helping my mother grow up because she doesn't know how to use Zoom or iPhone. I'm over there all the time being like, okay, now I told you, just tap this twice. You know, like, I got very lucky to have such loving parents, and they're imperfect, but I was always aware in both my sobriety and in writing about my life that I had privileges that other people didn't. You know, I talk to people that really, like, they come from very strict families where it's like, to write something like I did, they'd be disowned. And I my heart goes out to them because I had it really easy, really relatively easy.
Let's fast forward, Sarah. You've been sober for 11 years. I know we've got people that listen to this podcast, members within our community. Some are just starting out on their alcohol-free journey. They might be sober curious. They might be cutting down. They might be 6 months in going, when does this freaking magic start? But talking about writing the book there, and you said it took you 3 years in the end. It took you a fair amount of time. One thing I say with this whole sobriety lark, it takes patience. It takes the patience of a saint. You sort of can't undo 10, 20, 30, 40 years worth of drinking overnight. It takes work, it takes patience, but the payoff is immense. What's life like now for you 11 years down the line, 11 years on from that first chapter in that book that you shared?
I still work with patience. I mean, I think one of the reasons we become drinkers is that we love the instant gratification of changing the way that we feel in that moment. All it took was sometimes you didn't even have to put the alcohol in my mouth. I just had to hear the glug in the glass or the cork come out of the bottle. That's all it took. And that would change the way I feel. And I don't have that now. And it still hurts. It's never, some years are easier than others. Last year for me was a terrible year. It was a really, really hard year. But I've had tremendous years in sobriety. And what I found, I think, you know, I was so scared I wouldn't be interesting or fun. That was like a really big thing for me. And I think I am so much more interesting and fun now that I'm not falling off bar stools and like waking up in random places. And, you know, that's so tiresome. It's not really funny or interesting. Especially not after, you know, 10, 15 years. So I have a lot of confidence that I feel like I used to need to get through, you know, validation or like liquid courage, you know, like I needed liquid confidence because I didn't have my own confidence. So I've really been able to build that up. My friendships are so deep. My love relationships are so deep. The sex is so good when it's happening, and it isn't always. And that's frustrating too. And I have not found the great love of my life. I really thought I was such a lovelorn, I'm just like such a lonely heart. And when I was getting sober, I was like, I'm going to meet my husband in the rooms of AA. And, you know, that turned out as like in a gay meeting and I didn't even know it, which is just like so typical for me at the time. But like, I had one very profound love. Well, I've had two profound love relationships, but one of them was super deep. But it, you know, it wasn't, I didn't end up getting married. I didn't have kids. All of that was kind of a grief for me. I have a lot of lost time that I had to mourn. You know, I was 35 when I quit drinking. And I remember thinking like, can I just go two more years? Can I just do two more years? Like constant, you know, snooze on the alarm clock kind of thing. But then I got done with the book and I was in my early 40s and it was like, I just wish I'd quit sooner because I just wanted a chance to have kids and have a family and my time was running out for me biologically. All of this is stuff I go over in my second book, which I'm working on now. But I don't want to dwell too much on the tough stuff. The tough stuff is just life. The tough stuff is life and it's always going to be there and you can't drink it away and you can stay awake for it or you can go to sleep for it. And I know which one I want to be. It has given me, my sobriety is one of, if not the best thing I ever did. I just feel like I was wasting time, talent, energy. It just feels like a waste. And I say that as somebody that really loves, and I mean this, like I love booze. Like I when my friends are like, they love booze, I'm like, yeah, of course you do. Like, so it's like one of the greatest inventions known to man, you know? But like I abused it and I abused it for so long and I made so many excuses to keep it in my life when it really wasn't serving me and I couldn't see with clear eyes how much better things would be on the other side. I just never really believed it. But sometimes you just never really believe something until you experience it. But, you know, but now I know.
It's like half what you've just said there. It's just me. I just completely resonate with the whole thing, except I did it about probably 10 years later than you. I'm 48 now, so I started this when I was about 44. And I thought, okay, I'll never laugh again. I will never be funny again. I'll never have friends again. People won't think I'm interested. I will be the most boring person on this planet because alcohol simply defined who I was, you know, drank for confidence. It's a joke. I think back now, and I never needed it. I never needed it. And I think every credit for doing it in your 30s, and we have people that listen to this pod, we've had guests on this pod, and they're doing it now, they're doing it in the mid-20s, and we go, yes, you're saving yourself a whole world of pain. It's amazing. So
can you imagine if you quit in your 20s, like how much of your life would have been like opened up to you and how mature you would be? Like, instead of staying in this arrested state of adolescence that so many of us stay in, you know, to be an adult. I don't know. I find it so admirable.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely. So thank you.
Sarah, on that, I wanted to pick up on something you said earlier, which I really loved. And you talked about making sobriety matter. For me, I saw that in two different ways. And firstly, in terms of how much we gain in our lives from sobriety, as you just say, about opening up this whole world of opportunity, because it's so easy to say, I'm losing friendships, I'm losing my fun, I'm losing the all-nighters, I'm losing that glamorous adventure that I tell myself, but we are gaining so much. But the second, more deeper part, I think, is making sobriety matter helps people to understand that all of those things that we've been through, all of those mistakes that we've made, all of those blackouts that we've suffered, I believe that maybe they had to happen in some way, because if they didn't happen, we wouldn't be right here, right now, today, talking to wonderful people like yourself, be able to help other people around the world to get sober. And my question, because I believe I'm not coming to a question, is that if someone's listening to this and they are struggling to find the positivity in sobriety, if they're thinking, you know what, I'm just going to go back to those old ways because it was quite fun, how does anyone make sobriety matter for themselves?
It's such a good question. It's a really important question. And I think it's so deeply personal that this is why, like, no memoir or no guide to sobriety could ever, or even a wonderful podcast like yours, can ever really fully do the work of trying to figure out for somebody else what would make their life meaningful. I know that for me, it started small. I didn't want to talk to people. And so I liked reading because I could escape. And it's very funny because that was, I had stopped reading books for a while. I was just too drunk. But that was what I did when I was a little girl and I was shy. And that's why I became a writer, was because I would escape into those books. And it's lame, maybe, but it was a joy. It was a total joy to immerse myself in someone else's story. I remember the first time that I like started singing along to music again. I was always like a karaoke like superstar when I was drunk. And then you know when I'm really depressed because I don't listen to music, but I started listening to music and I was singing along to it. And it was like you hold on to those little joys. It doesn't have to be stuff like you run marathons. That's super cool. Like I wrote a book. That's super cool. But it doesn't have to be something big to matter. It can be something as small as remembering tucking your child into bed that night. It can be something as small and glorious as waking up without a hangover and listening to the birds in the morning. Waking up, period. You know, like it's those things. I had stopped caring for myself, but I had stopped caring about the world. The little things, my cat, who I loved, and you know, I was so careless with him. And, you know, connecting to your friends that are there, like you just kind of like, I think of it like that moment in The Wizard of Oz when like all of a sudden everything goes into technicolor. That's what sobriety is. It's an opportunity to see everything in a new way. And you didn't even know the old way was black and white, you know? But you have to discover it. So, you know, but I think like song, dance, laughter, connection, those are the good things in life. And then I just ate a lot of ice cream too, because I needed that.
Same.
When you said that quote about, you know, I had to make sobriety matter and make sobriety better, like, I've always had that in the sense of, oh, I'd love to write a book, but who's going to read it? Or I'd love to paint something, but who's going to see it? And I know what you mean about, you know, if you're not enjoying that moment of sobriety, at least if I'm sober and I'm writing this book about sobriety, so at least I'm making it matter, at least I'm making it better because there's an outcome, I think is what I took from what you were saying. When did the flip happen? How long do you think it took until you realised that actually it wasn't any outcomes of sobriety, but sobriety itself that mattered?
That's a really good question, and I don't think I've ever been asked it before. And so I made a little face because I was like, I'm going to have to think this out in real time. I wonder the answer to that. You know, I can say that, and this is not a part of my story I'm super proud of, but like, just facts. It's kind of easy to stay sober when you write a book, you get a bunch of money for it, the book becomes a bestseller, everybody loves it, and you're the toast of the town. I mean, it was the best thing I'd ever done. Look at this, all the cash and prizes. And did I want to be sober? Yes. Did I love sobriety? Yes. But I can't really untangle it from the massive fire hose of attention and goodwill that came my way because of doing this. And so it really wasn't until the years after Blackout, when I got stuck in a writing rut, trying to make my next bestseller, because I had to make it a bestseller, which was a total mistake to have that frame of mind. You know, and I was like in one relationship that wouldn't work after another, and I was on one revision of the book that wouldn't work after the other. And I was locked up, and I felt locked up in my own. See, I was social distancing before it became a thing. Pandemic hit, and I was like, yeah, I'm already there, guys. Like, I was so socially distanced, spiritually distanced. And it really took me kind of breaking down over that. And I would start to go, I would go to a meeting. I remember going to a meeting and breaking down like a damn newcomer and sobbing And all the people afterward, you know, hovering around me and like giving me pamphlets. And I'm like, I'm 10 years sober. Like, I don't need your pamphlets. I've been here for a long time. I'm just a mess right now. And they were there. Like, my recovery community is always there. And my sobriety, I held on to it through the toughest passage of my adulthood. And I couldn't be more grateful for it. I mean, I just couldn't. And I got, I didn't struggle with drinking for about 3 or 4 or 5 years, but I struggled last year. And I didn't do it. I started smoking again. That wasn't awesome. Smoking cigarettes. But it was one of those, like, we got to do something. Like, we got to do something and damage control. And so that's what I did. And it was, you know, this is something, I hate telling these stories to people that are new in sobriety because they're like, ooh, that sounds really gross. I won't do that in 10 years. But this is also a life story. And I think it's also important for people to know, because you get into that glide of like 2, 3, 4 years and you're like, I would never do it differently. I'm never going to take this back. You get to 10 years sometimes. It was very common. And there's just a weird plateau and it's not going in the, it's not going up and up and up. It's going like this, flat. And the addict in you that wants more and wants better and wants bigger is hungry. And you have to learn to release that and turn it over, whatever you've decided you need to turn it over to. So it took me a lot longer to really find, like, no, it's sobriety that is the gift. It's not the book and the attention and all that stuff. You know, I had to kind of learn that the hard way, by which I say the lucrative and attractive way.
Got our community members watching, and Nikki just talked about you saying that that the first year was quite miserable, it was difficult, and then she says, what would you say was the biggest factor that motivated you to stay sober? I think you've just completely covered that, Sarah, which was brilliant, so thank you so much. And just referring back to what you said before, we were talking about parenting and your mum, Sarah, who's on the call, she says she's doing it in her 60s now, and for the record, Sarah is absolutely smashing this whole sobriety lark, hundreds and hundreds of days under a belt. And she just says, I wish I'd done it 40 years ago. I feel I've waited so many years. But I also now feel that I too am growing up with my children. And I love growing up with them. 19 months sober. And she'll be really enjoying this call. So thank you so much.
That's super awesome. And I think it's so cool that somebody's getting sober in their 60s. You can get sober in your 70s and your 80s. You know, Molly Ivins, one of the great Texas writers, she got sober right before she died, but she died sober. And that was a beautiful thing. It was a meaningful thing to her.
Sarah, it's been a pleasure. This hour has absolutely flowed. We could easily do 3, and hopefully you'll come back and chat with us again on the pod in the future, because we'll want to talk about the second book, and because we all want to buy it. Please tell us what it's going to be called, if you can, and when we can get our hands on it.
Well, it's a really good question. We're still discussing the title now. I want to call it The Love We Came to Know. And I don't know when it would be out, maybe 2023. But, you know, it's really about the discovery of love that you make along the way, thinking that you're going to get a different kind of love and appreciating what you got instead. Oh, but if you like me, you can also listen to my Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders podcast, America's Girls, which is a 8-part narrative series about the epic saga of the Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders.
I would love to.
Yes.
I would love to.
You know what? I was reading about this yesterday. I was absolutely reading about this, Sarah. It's going on my list. It sounds fascinating. And I wanted to talk about it a bit on the pod, but we've run out of time. We've absolutely run out of time. So that is ace. And just remind people about your social media handles. Where can we find you on Insta and all that jazz?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on Instagram at the Sarah Heppala Experience. And I'm on Twitter at just Sarah Heppala. And I finally participate in Twitter this year. I've been faking it for years. But anybody who follows me will actually get bona fide Sarah Heppala handcrafted thoughts. instead of the PR bot stuff I was putting out before now. And I have a Facebook page. I don't know what the... It's like Sarah Heppel a blackout or something like that.
Fabulous.
Join us.
Fabulous. If you haven't read Sarah's book yet, you must. It's an absolute essential in your quit lit toolkit, blackout, remembering the things I drank to forget. Sarah, thank you so much. We have thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it, and we hope you have too. Thank you. I know I shouldn't say this. I probably say this every week anyway. That was one of my most favourite episodes, wasn't Sarah? Absolutely fantastic. Just as honest on Over the Influence as she is in her book, Blackout. Unreal.
She was amazing. Loved it. Funny, informative, very, very wise and everything else. I think she was a fabulous guest and definitely going to go down as a classic episode.
Superb. Can't wait for book two as well.
And guys, just to check, I didn't... It wasn't too much, was it? You know, I managed to really hide the fact that I'm a huge Sarah Heppler blackout.
You know what, actually, Ben?
Keep my cool.
For the first time in the history, of Over the Influence, since we began around that dining room table back in 2000, whenever it was, never before have you interrupted the intro. Never before have you overtaken an intro. Never before have you introed a guest. I mean, I just saw him crumble, Freddie. Did you? He just was like, oh, it's Sarah Heffler. Welcome to the podcast. My name's Ben.
The structure, the process, the rule book, it all went out of the window.
It all went to shit, didn't it? Structure.
In a massive explosion of gay abandon, we said, let's just go with our feelings and to hell with the rules.
Mm. I like it when Ben uses it.
Same with Claire Pooley. I genuinely love these books, and they genuinely had a huge impact on me in the early days.
And I
can't believe we're doing this.
I love it. I love the fact that it's had an impact on you. We've witnessed this ourselves. You know, we've said, Ben, just try this book, read it. And you're like, oh my God, it's changing my life. Try this one. Oh my God, it's changing my life. Ben, we've got Claire Pooley. We've got Sarah Heppel on the pod. Oh my God, you are kidding me. And you've just lost your marbles. It's brilliant.
I have. Oh, Freddie, I spot an opportunity here. You know what else might change your life this week, Sharon?
Oh, no, actually, Ben, no. I don't know. Freddie, do you?
I have a feeling, Sharon, that it might. Surely it couldn't. Could it be the Over the Influence premium podcast?
Oh,
that's exactly what I'm talking about, Freddie.
That sounds interesting.
Amazing. I was hoping it was going to be that.
Yeah, we're doing a premium podcast every week now, guys. So if you got to the end of this episode and you thought, God, I just really want some more Over the Influence this week, then you can subscribe to our premium podcast, where it's us three talking about all different things to do with alcohol-free life. This week on the premium podcast, Sharon, you talked about...
Was it that memorable, Ben? That memorable?
I'm all in a fluster.
I know you are.
Sarah Heppler.
You're still very, very flustered. In this week's premium pod, I talk about something that I'd seen on Instagram. We're big fans of the Gay Sober. He's been on the podcast before, and each day through January, he's sharing just some brilliant, brilliant top tips. Today's was about the fact that you don't need to have a problem with alcohol in order to remove it from your life, and when you sort of like put it out there and say, you know what, I've made a change, I'm taking a break, and people's reactions, it can be so, excuse my bleep this bit out, it can be so shitty at times. And it's about ploughing on and just not caring.
I don't need to bleep that, Shaz. We've said way worse things than shitty.
Yeah. We've said far, far worse. So that's what I'm talking about. Freddie, what are you on about? What are you blathering on about in the premium podcast?
So I give some inside scoops to what it's like running a marathon. 10 years after I first tried to run a marathon when I was at the height of my drinking. Newsflash, it's going to be controversial, but believe it or not, when you're not getting smashed five nights a week, then it is easier to run a marathon when you're sober. But the main thing I talk about is the mindset change that can hit us a bit further down the track. And I talk about some struggles I've been facing recently. I talk about some very vivid dreams I've been having recently. And I talk about how we can overcome some obstacles that we face down the sober road. But to understand all those secrets of what I've been talking about, you will have to download and hear for yourself.
I wang on about Chrissy Teigen.
Yeah, you do.
6 months sober. And role models. We have an interesting conversation about role models. That's all on the premium podcast, overtheinfluence.supercast.com. And not only can you get to hear all of that, you don't just get to hear new episodes when you subscribe, you get to hear every single premium podcast that we've ever recorded.
Actually,
and there's hours and hours
lot.
And hours of this
that's
stuff
a
in
lot.
There now.
Isn't it?
There's
shed
a lot
loads.
Of stuff in there.
We've been recording this thing since last July. So there's, I counted up, there's over 20 hours. If you think right back to the beginning, we have these, the episode, yeah, the Summer Sober Survival Guide. We talk about alcohol-free parties, barbecues, weddings, events. So not only is this bloody good sober entertainment, it actually gives a whole vault of tactical support. So if you are facing any situation and you're thinking, oh, crikey, how am I going to get through this sober? Or you just need a reminder, or you need an arm around the shoulder, or a rocket up the backside, or whatever it is you need. Here you have it in this
both,
vault
please.
Of sober gold. And yeah, maybe an arm around the shoulder and a rocket up the backside. Don't knock it till you tried it. But there is so much there to say. Over 20 hours worth of content every single back episode. So you could start listening to the premium pod tomorrow, and you could listen for 8 hours a day, and you would be listening for the whole of the week. Imagine that. Nothing but Shazza, Ben and myself coming in your ears for 8 hours a day for a whole week.
Yeah, not recommended. That's a lot
a
of
bit
us.
Much, isn't
That's
it?
A lot of us.
A bit much.
Yeah, pace yourselves.
Pace yourselves.
Don't peak too soon. Over the influence. Great. Supercast.com. Ben, I'm not going to let you go without you doing it in your radio advert voice, please, just for me.
Well, yes, Sharon, I'm really hoping you were going to say that, because it's my voice that it paid the bills for about 6 months, this radio advertising voice. The new Vauxhall course already, $6,995. That is a joke. overtheinfluence.supercast.com. That's overtheinfluence.supercast.com. Go there now, subscribe. £5 a month. Oh, my God, just £5? Yes, just £5. overtheinfluence.supercast.com.
Thank you, Daymaid. That's all I needed. Bye.